Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Crassie Twigg from the Global Jigsaw podcast, where we're asking, 10 years after the start of the war in Yemen, where do the warring parties stand? This battle between rival camps in the Middle East has reached a stalemate. Is there a way out? The Global Jigsaw looks at the world through the lens of its media, getting past the narratives, the propaganda and the disinformation. Find us wherever you get your BBC World Service podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour for the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. Coming up a little later, a treat for fans of the soul legend Booker T, who began his long hit-making career while he was still at school. More from him in just under 20 minutes. But we are going to begin in southern Lebanon and a series of incidents in which Israeli forces have fired on UN peacekeepers based in that region. They've been there for decades, but their most recent mission has been to enforce a buffer zone between Israel and Hezbollah following Israel's last invasion in 2006. That's under what's known as Security Council Resolution 1701. Currently about 10,000 peacekeepers belonging to the mission called UNIFIL are stationed in southern Lebanon. But four times in recent days, Israeli troops are reported to have fired at the UN peacekeepers' bases. Their headquarters in the coastal city of Nakura was struck again today. Two Sri Lankan peacekeepers were injured by explosions, still being investigated. On Thursday, two Indonesian soldiers were injured by Israeli fire, an attack condemned by the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Obviously, I condemn the fact that there was shooting against the UN premise, wounding two peacekeepers, which is a violation of international humanitarian law. Peacekeepers must be protected by all parties of the conflict. And what has happened is obviously condemnable. There was naturally a reaction from many sides in solidarity with the peacekeepers that were wounded, and telling Israel very clearly that this incident is intolerable and it cannot be repeated.
Andrea Tenenti is spokesperson for the UN peacekeeping mission. He's been talking to our correspondent in Lebanon, Orla Guerin.
So this is very concerning because we have seen a lot in the last 12 months, exchanges of fire, but this time it looks more of a deliberate attack against our troops who have been in the south to try to bring back stability at the moment. It is very, very challenging. And the IDF, the Israeli forces, told us a few days ago, after they told us that they were coming, entering inside Lebanon, that we should move from all the areas close to the blue line, all the positions. We have 29 positions close to the blue line. But it was a decision taken by all the troop-contributing countries to stay.
As far as you are concerned, these are deliberate attacks by the Israeli army on UN peacekeeping troops.
We are looking at some of the attacks, but some of them they look pretty deliberate. When you fire at the cameras, when you fire at illumination inside the base, and the tower closed inside the headquarters of the mission, so it's very something that we are still trying to ask the Israeli authorities for some explanation of what happened. But it's a very serious development because it's also the obligation of the parties to preserve the safety and security of our troops. So this is a violation of international humanitarian law as well as a violation of Resolution 1701.
Is it a war crime? There have been suggestions from some in the Italian government that this could be a war crime.
I know that several governments have been very vocal about what happened. We are still looking into that, but definitely it's very serious development to attack peacekeepers.
Do you think the Israelis are trying to force you out? They told you to go, you said no. Are they trying to force UN peacekeepers to leave?
Of course, people can analyze it in this way. They've told us to move from certain position for our safety and security. But I think when you see how things have developed in recent days, it's very difficult to think why are they doing this right now.
Andrea Tenenti. And we did ask the Israeli military to explain what happened, but we're told that no one was available to speak to us. Further north in the capital, Beirut, people are still counting the cost of last night's Israeli airstrikes, which destroyed several buildings in two districts of central Beirut. At least 22 people were killed, more than 110 others injured. Ala Beydoun is a local resident.
I was praying. We heard the first strike, and I thought it was in my house. The second one was much more powerful than the first one. People went down barefoot. They were screaming. We didn't know anything at the start. I went to see where the strike was, and I saw that in my house, the glass and windows had shattered. We came and saw this scene. It was horrifying. It was something unbelievable.
It is Israel's deadliest attack on central Beirut so far. Until now, its airstrikes have been concentrated on southern parts of the city where Hezbollah has a strong presence. Reports in Lebanese media suggest the target for Thursday's strikes was a top Hezbollah commander, although he reportedly survived. Mona Fawaz is Professor of Urban Studies and Planning at the American University of Beirut. She's been telling me about the areas of the city that were hit.
The neighborhoods that were hit last night are really like less than a kilometer away from Beirut's historic core. These are neighborhoods that have a very dense urban fabric, mostly residential. I mean, if your listeners live in a neighborhood where when you walk down the street, you have all the new buildings, the ground floor is grocery stores, hairdressers, bookstores, maybe a gym. That's the kind of area that we're talking about. They have a lot of heritage buildings because they are right around the historic core of the city. So this is like when Beirut in the 1920s had grown. And of course, they're incredibly dense right now because aside from their normal population, they also have welcomed a lot of people who have fled both South Lebanon and some of the neighborhoods of Beirut's southern suburbs where they were coming under Israeli fire already.
And Mona, are people in Beirut shocked that this part of the city was struck by Israel yesterday?
I think people are really scared. I don't know that they're shocked. The kind of crimes that we've seen over the last year, you know, this cycle of it's called targeted and then it gets reported as targeted while in reality a whole building falls and everyone dies and then it's described as fighting terrorism and more weapons are sent, kind of has sent us all a message that anyone can be killed anytime. So I would say we're less shocked than actually really afraid and wondering when there will actually be something that will stop Israel from this rogue attack on residential neighborhoods.
And there was no warning yesterday given, was there?
Absolutely not. No, it was a total surprise. I mean, I have one of the researchers who works in my lab who lives right across from there, and she was completely puzzled. They heard massive explosion. The whole building fell down. She has two young daughters who were screaming. Everyone was trying to either take their kids out of the neighborhood or try to help the people who to see how they can move the rubble. You know, it's a country that's also quite devastated. The government doesn't have money, so it's really relying a lot on people and solidarity in order to even remove people and help them get to the hospitals. So definitely no warning and definitely a fully residential neighborhood.
Mona, just one final question. Israel says its war is with Hezbollah, not the Lebanese people more broadly. And earlier this week, he asked people to rise up against the group. Is that possible?
Look, I mean, the Israeli army is sending videos around and showing that all people in Lebanon are hiding weapons under their mattresses, and they want the whole world to imagine that this is what it's like in Lebanon. The truth of the matter is that this is a huge movement that's completely ingrained in society. It doesn't mean it's weaponized. It just means that it's very difficult to imagine that you can rise or not rise against anyone, because, I mean, everyone has become today a target. I don't know, the person who cleans the offices of the media offices in one of the TV stations for Hezbollah is a target now. Do we move against them? How does that work? So I think there's a misunderstanding of the extent to which we are talking about a fine-grained society that's extremely diverse. And in all honesty, I mean, we saw Netanyahu's message as a blunt attack on the Lebanese society. We saw it as a threat. We were told we either kill each other or they will turn us into Gaza. These were the words.
Professor Mona Fawaz. Well, let's head to the Israel-Lebanon border now, because at the far eastern end, close to the northernmost Israeli town of Matula, well, that's seen heavy rocket fire from Lebanon in the past few days. The BBC's Lucy Williamson was taken into the town, now under military blockade, by the Israeli army.
The Israeli border town of Matula juts right up into Hezbollah territory. The Israeli army is taking us in. Nadav Shoshani is a military spokesman.
You can see now we're protected by the trees, but if there is a Hezbollah terrorist in there, he has a direct line of fire and has direct sight of us.
No one has lived here for a year except the military. In that time, half the houses have been hit by Hezbollah.
We're walking quickly up this road because it's part of the village that's exposed and in direct line of sight from one of the Lebanese villages. This community is perhaps the most exposed in Israel, surrounded by Lebanon on three sides. Part of it, too dangerous to even enter.
Israel's ground invasion of Lebanon began along this stretch of border. The mayor, David Azulay, shows us where a rocket landed in a house last week. It's the third time this house has been hit in the past few months. Then, sirens. Here, you have seconds to find cover. We hear Israel's air defences intercept the barrage overhead. Civil defence teams monitor Hezbollah activity around Matula 24 hours a day.
The goal of these cameras is to make sure there's no terror attack against us.
We're taken into the war room, run by civil defence volunteers like Sharon.
2, 3, 4 weeks ago, we could still see some movements and activities from Hezbollah.
Every day?
Almost every day.
It's a narrow, cramped space, filled with more than a dozen screens, its cameras picking out the traces of Israel's invasion last week, and buildings destroyed in neighbouring Lebanese villages.
In the last few weeks, because of IDF operations, they have moved back a bit, or hid, and focused heavier on projectiles and rocket fire, rather than those suicide drones or direct fire like anti-tanks or RPGs.
160 rockets were fired at Matula on a single day last week. Another house was hit 4 days ago. The kind of attack Nadav Shoshani says Israel's invasion is meant to stop.
Hezbollah terrorists are within a few hundred meters from these houses. Right behind us, in that ridge, is Lebanon. And while IDF troops are operating, Hezbollah has been embedding itself and preparing for a war with Israel for decades, building bunkers and rockets under houses in southern Lebanon. We have to go. There's an alert, and okay. We'll keep on going.
Okay.
We leave to more warnings of rockets. Matula, a litmus test of Israel's war goals, is still empty of residents, not yet secure.
Our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson reporting there from the far north of Israel. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Still to come on the programme, remains and clothing found on Everest are those of the British climber Sandy Irving, who perished there a century ago, along with George Mallory.
The label said A.C. Irving. And I just gave a really loud gasp, and I had tears in my eyes, and I thought, my God, this is incredible.
More on that story in half an hour. Our main headlines from the BBC newsroom. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has condemned Israel's firing on peacekeepers' positions in southern Lebanon as intolerable and a violation of international humanitarian law. And this year's Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to the Japanese anti-nuclear group Nihon Hidankyo, which is made up of survivors of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki attacks. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. Now, the BBC has discovered that the British government is investigating 37 businesses with links to the UK for potentially breaking Russian oil sanctions. But no fines have been handed out so far. After Russia invaded Ukraine in early 2022, the UK and other Western countries stopped buying Russian oil. The UK and the EU also made it illegal to facilitate the transportation of Russian oil, sold for more than $60 a barrel. The idea was to make it harder for Russia to finance its war, but without creating a global oil shock. Well, the discovery was made under what's known as a Freedom of Information request from our political reporter Jack Fenwick. So what are the businesses? What do they do exactly?
We don't know the identities of the businesses involved in these 37 investigations, but we can get an idea of what it is they do based on what the Russian oil cap actually is. So from that, we can work out that these companies are likely to be ship insurers and others involved in that process.
It's more than 2.5 years since the war started. Why has progress in these investigations been so slow?
The Treasury have pointed to the complex nature of a lot of these investigations as a reason why it may be taking a while to find people. But what we do know is that further to these 37 investigations, another 15 have actually concluded, and they also didn't result in a fine. Now, the UK government did actually fine a company last month for a different Russia-related sanction, not to do with oil. But in terms of oil sanctions, we just don't seem to be seeing any payments. Now, some people say that's because of pressure from other parts of the international community. For example, the US were quite worried when some of these sanctions were brought in that they didn't want them to go too hard and potentially raise the price of oil. So you've got lots of complicated issues flowing around this stuff.
Are there also loopholes that companies are able to exploit to get round this set of sanctions?
So there is one main loophole which we know is being used and is resulting in oil that started life in Russia making its way to the UK. And that's because legally, if crude oil is refined in a third country, the country of origin becomes that third country. So you can look at the graphs and see that as imports of Russian oil have dropped off a cliff since the invasion of Ukraine, UK imports of Indian oil, for example, have gone up quite a lot. And what's happening is that Russian crude is being refined in India. That then is technically Indian oil, not Russian oil, and then it can be imported.
How do these sanctions fit into the wider tranche of sanctions in place against Russia?
So there have been sanctions in place against Russia for a number of years, going back to the invasion of Crimea in 2014, but a lot of them were introduced after the wider invasion of Ukraine in 2022. Now, one of the main things is sanctioning individuals. That's when we hear stories about certain Russian oligarchs that can no longer do business in the UK, have had their assets frozen. But there are also these financial sanctions on bits of the Russian economy. I think it's fair to say that the oil cap is probably the most significant of those and is really the one that was aimed to try and make it very difficult for Russia to make as much money off the oil industry as they had done and therefore make it more difficult to fund that war. But there are other things, for example, just this week, the UK government set up a new team to go after companies that are breaking trade sanctions. As I understand it, they're going to be particularly looking at the financial services sector when it comes to that.
Now, campaigners who support the oil sanctions say they're not being enforced properly, then that's why they're not effective. What's the Treasury, what's the government saying?
The UK Treasury said that it would be taking enforcement action where appropriate, were the words that they used, and they said that they were putting sanction breaches on notice. They also pointed to the complex nature of a lot of these cases and said that's why it can take such a long time. But campaigners are saying that, and one of the things they're pointing to is the fact that the Russian economy is growing. These sanctions to do with the oil cap are related to Russian oil traded at more than $60 a barrel. Well, Russian oil has been trading at more than $60 a barrel ever since these sanctions came in. So it's that sort of thing that critics point to.
Our political reporter, Jack Fenwick. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Do stay with us. We've got lots more coming up in the second half of the programme.
I'm Crassie Twigg from the Global Jigsaw podcast, where we are asking, 10 years after the start of the war in Yemen, where do the warring parties stand? This battle between rival camps in the Middle East has reached a stalemate. Is there a way out? The Global Jigsaw looks at the world through the lens of its media, getting past the narratives, the propaganda and the disinformation. Find us wherever you get your BBC World Service podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. In a moment, we'll be discussing the award of this year's Nobel Peace Prize to an organisation representing the survivors of the two American atomic bomb attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But first, even as Israel expands its military operations against Hezbollah in Lebanon, its offensive against Hamas in Gaza is continuing. When the war began a year ago, borders were shut, which left people from Gaza visiting the other Palestinian territory of the West Bank stranded. Clive Myrie has been speaking to a grandfather and his granddaughter, now separated by war.
The Retro Hotel off Al-Khalud Street in Ramallah is a little run down. In one of its starkly furnished rooms, bed, TV, wardrobe and fridge, a conversation breaks the monotony for Ibrahim Ashatali.
Where is he?
The 54-year-old is on a video call with his 5-year-old granddaughter, Isla. It's a snatched moment of solace. On the bed are packets of pills, testament to Ibrahim's prostate cancer, which forced him to leave Isla and his family in Gaza last September, in the hope of treatment on the West Bank. He was due to return to Gaza on October the 8th last year, the day after Hamas attacked Israel, and Israel responded by attacking Gaza. Now he's stuck in this cheap hotel. As he speaks, there's an air of resignation.
Her smell sticks with me. It doesn't leave. We are really close. I take her to the beach, the market. I had a motorbike, and I put her on the front. When she heard the sound of the bike, she jumped and said, "Granddad is here," and ran to me.
Isla and her family are now nomads in Gaza, fleeing from place to place, avoiding Israeli bombs. They've been uprooted at least 5 times, each departure a flight for survival. Ibrahim is melancholic. He can't help his own family.
They've moved to many places, and sometimes we can't communicate. It's really hard to reach them. Sometimes I sit here alone and cry because I can't do anything. I should be responsible for them and protect them, but I'm far away.
Wars yield broken communities, separation, and loneliness. Across the divide in Gaza, a granddad and his grandchild are trying to keep hope alive. Their video calls, glimmers of light in all the gloom.
I miss you so much, Granddad. When will the war end? When will you come back here safe?
That report from Ramallah in the occupied West Bank by the BBC's Clive Myrie. You're listening to News. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC in London. I'm James Menendez. Now, this year's Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to the Japanese anti-nuclear group Nihon Hidankyo, which is made up of survivors of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki attacks. Speaking at a news conference in Oslo, the chair of the Norwegian Nobel Committee made the announcement.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Peace Prize for 2024 to the Japanese organization Nihon Hidankyo. This grassroots movement of atomic bomb survivors from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, also known as Hibakusha, is receiving the Peace Prize for its efforts to achieve a world free of nuclear weapons.
Well, a little earlier on, I spoke to Toshiko Tanaka. She lives in Hiroshima and survived the blast. She was 6 years old at the time, and she's worked alongside Nihon Hidankyo over the years. I asked her, first of all, how she felt about them winning the prize.
I am very glad. I can't believe it. It's true.
What do you think it means for the organization and its work?
So since after the World War II, Hidankyo, the organization, has been working very hard to tell the world the terror of the atomic bomb. And partly because of that, that nuclear weapon has been never been used in wars for nearly 80 years. However, it seems like there's a lot of fear going on in Russia, for example, and Israel. There is a growing concern that the nuclear weapon might be used again. So it is important for us to voice again.
Do you think that people are forgetting about the horrors of nuclear weapons and what they can do?
So I think world is, yes, the world is forgetting about the fear, the terror of the atomic bombing. However, there's a hope as well. I visited 18 countries this year. I met young activists all over the world, and they recognized the terror of the atomic bombing, nuclear weapons. And these people are taking what is going on in Russia or Ukraine as if it's their own things. So I have a lot of hope for this younger generation.
Toshiko, you were 6 years old, I think, when the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. Do you still remember clearly what happened that fateful day?
Yes, I do. I clearly remember what happened. I'm 85, so I might sometimes forget what I ate yesterday, but I still remember what happened on that day. I saw an airplane in the sky. Then all of a sudden, there was a tremendous flash. And I got burned, my head and my neck. And right arm was burned. Then suddenly everything went dark because we are under the mushroom cloud. Then I went home. I went back to home, which was my house was entirely destroyed. Then my mother, didn't recognize me because I was covered by ash and my appearance was changed so much. And then I saw the procession of people who are severely burned, walking silently in the procession, and they look like zombies.
Yes, people sometimes describe them as ghosts, the ghosts of Hiroshima.
The ghost might be a better description.
And what was your experience in the years after 1945, how was your health, for example? How were survivors treated in Japan?
After the war, we lost everything. And however, for 6 years, the Japanese people were not informed about radioactivity. So people knew nothing about it. So they built very humble houses and they started to grow vegetable on contaminated soil. We drank water, contaminated water. We didn't know anything about the radioactivity. I know at least 10 of my friends or people that who died after that. And I suspect that was because of that radioactivity.
I understand you didn't speak about your experiences until you were 70. Why did you remain silent for so long?
It was very hard for me to remember. And also, there was a discrimination in the society. And for example, your kids might be discriminated when they get married. So that is the reason why many people silence themselves.
Do you think nuclear weapons will ever be abolished now that the genie is out of the bottle?
I would like to believe in the wisdom of people or humanity. There's a lot of wars going on in Israel, Ukraine, and Gaza. And these things are happening because, as the chain of retaliation. And I really want people to start talking and stop before it gets really the worst. And I really strongly believe in people's wisdom.
Toshiko Tanaka, survivor of Hiroshima, who's worked alongside the winners of this year's Nobel Peace Prize. And we should give our thanks to her daughter, Reiko, who translated for us and whose voice you heard during that interview. To Florida now, where the destruction caused by Hurricane Milton's becoming clear. Governor Ron DeSantis says the state has avoided the worst-case scenario, but there has been widespread damage and at least 16 people are known to have been killed. Thousands have been rescued from flooded areas. 2.5 million homes and businesses are still without power. Tom Bateman reports now from the town of Clearwater on Florida's Gulf Coast.
This had memorabilia of mine since middle school. Stuff from my dead grandmother.
Zane Jake Tucker's apartment is ruined.
All gone.
He walks me round, here on the ground floor, as mud and the debris of a palm tree litter the doorway.
This is the water line? Yeah.
This is the water line. I think this is where it stayed at, because when we were in the house, it was a bit higher.
Zane says there were no evacuation orders for these homes. Instead, he and flatmate Dania Fleury watch the waters rise, helpless.
What are you able to grab?
What's in my hand right now? Are those your sinkers? I figured we'd take a case of water to your dad's house.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now he's come back to survey the damage. With the growing intensity of Florida storms, insurance costs have soared. Zane and Dania couldn't afford it, and she says they've lost everything. But at least they didn't pay with their lives.
There's a canal right behind us here. There's gators in that water. So there's a big fence, hole in the fence. So I was like, first thing I'm thinking, like, we're going to be eaten by alligators.
Outside his house, a car is flattened by a fallen tree. Zane grew up here, but he wonders how much longer he can stay.
My whole life, born and raised.
I mean, we've had two big hurricanes back to back now. I mean, what does that make you think and feel?
They told me when I was in elementary and middle school that Florida would be underwater in 10 to 15 years, and I think that's what's happening, just Mother Nature fighting back.
In the buildings next door, hundreds on the ground floor fled to neighbours upstairs when Milton came. They had to be rescued by boat at dawn. The storm arrived less than a fortnight after Hurricane Helene tore through this area, a community inundated with floodwater and fear.
What you can hear there is a giant pump that is trying to draw the water level down. Home upon home, a street that's really become a river, cars that are submerged. I can see a motorbike with its windshield just sticking out of the ripples of the flood here. And the sense I get from residents here is just about how much more they can take. They've had two hurricanes back to back in a fortnight now. And some have asked the question, how long they can keep going like this when the risk of this just seems to be getting worse and worse by the year.
Are you in the shelter at the moment?
We're just actually coming to grab our stuff to go home.
Can I ask your name?
Emily.
What happened to your home?
Actually, with Hurricane Helene, it was underneath 12 foot of storm surge, and then this one just, we tried to haul ass as quick as we could. Wow. So we're about to go see how much damage is at the house, so.
So you're already damaged from Helene. Mm-hmm. So you came here the night before Milton.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now you're going back to the first time. Do you know if you've got any damage?
Yeah. We already know. We're expecting it.
That will end around 5 this afternoon. Please keep those in the damaged areas in your prayers. Check this station's website.
On the car radio, the ads try to help lift the mood, even if they are for a roofing company.
This update brought to you by Covenant Roofing, where the difference is the promise.
We head east, following Milton's path, on a highway-side trail of flooding and debris. The hurricane had downgraded before landfall, sparing Florida the most dire warnings of the worst in a century storm. But there is still severe damage, and officials think 3 days of evacuation warnings from President Biden downwards saved many lives here. Some feel, though, they are now just counting time until the next major hurricane.
OK, Norman, and you have a companion with you.
We do. This is Louis.
This is Louis the dog. What's it been like for him?
He's done OK.
He's been fine.
Nancy and Norman Stewart from Tampa evacuated 100 miles inland to Orlando, and now they're about to go home again.
So do you know what the state of your home is, your area yet?
Luckily, I was just talking with my neighbor. She said all of our units are safe. We were very, very fortunate.
When you saw how quickly this storm intensified from a 1 to a 5, I mean, what went through your mind?
We had to get out.
Yeah. Then we knew that we had to evacuate.
Nearby, I meet Teresa and Jim, who also fled Tampa. Jim's lived his whole life here and seen many a storm, but believes things are changing.
We've been through a few, yeah. This one was a pretty bad one, though.
How does it make you feel about where this is going in terms of the weather and, you know, living in a state like Florida?
That it's not going to get better.
Yeah, people who do not believe in global warming need to come to Florida and see what happens when a hurricane can intensify from a 1 to a 5 in 24 hours.
And now they return again to see the damage for themselves. Many will wonder how many times they can keep coming home.
And that was Tom Bateman reporting from Clearwater on Florida's Gulf Coast. You're listening to NewsHour. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. Now, it is a trial which has gripped people in France for weeks, appalled that a husband could drug his wife and procure her rape by dozens of other men. The decision of Gisèle Pelicot to waive her right to anonymity has evoked enormous respect. But by that act, she's confronted both the men accused and France more generally. Not an unknown victim, in adverted commas, but a wife, a mother, a grandmother, a human being like any other. As are the men on trial. In court, the men are being confronted with explicit video footage recorded at the time by Gisèle's now former husband, Dominique. Many of the defendants continue to insist they didn't believe what they were doing was rape. Andrew Harding reports from Avignon, where the trial's taking place.
She's getting used to the daily applause now. Gisèle Pelicot arriving in court as usual, cheered by members of the public. The rape victim who refuses to be shamed, a symbol in France and beyond of defiance. But today, the focus is not on her or her ex-husband, who's admitted to drugging and raping her for years. Instead, this extraordinary trial is now focusing on the 50 other men, some out on bail, faces hidden under masks and hoods, men who are accused of raping Pelicot as she lay unconscious in her own bed. In court, each man in turn has been confronted with footage of what they did, including video showing Pelicot snoring as she's assaulted. We've just been shown yet more videos filmed by Dominique Pelicot over the years inside the couple's bedroom. They are shocking. I'm not going to go into details of what we saw, but clearly the prosecution believes that this is overwhelming evidence that those men who came into that bedroom must have known that Gisèle Pelicot was unconscious, that she could not have consented to what happened to her. But most of these accused men insist they are not rapists, that they genuinely believed that they were taking part in some sort of consensual sex game with the couple. Paul Roger Gontard is a lawyer defending one of the accused.
Gisèle Pelicot is a victim. We are sure about that. A victim of her husband, a victim of other guys, but we are not sure she's a victim of all the guys.
Some of those on trial say they were tricked by Dominique Pelicot, intimidated by him. At his house on the edge of Avignon, we spoke to one such man and agreed to keep his identity hidden since the trial is still ongoing.
Et là, je me suis dit, il n'est pas normal, cet homme, c'est un psychopathe.
I said to myself, he's not normal. This man is a psychopath. I was terrified, naked, caught in a trap.
Is there not within you any shred of feeling of responsibility for what you did?
Ça m'a transformé, cette affaire.
But the man offered no real answer, insisting he was simply a victim.
Jamais.
Which helps explain the frustration of so many still queuing to watch this trial every day, inspired by Gisèle Pellico's courage, but worried too that some of the accused may be hunting for excuses for the inexcusable.
Andrew Harding reporting there from France. Now, it is one of the great mysteries of Mount Everest. Did George Mallory, together with his partner, Andrew Comyn Irvine, or Sandy, reach the summit of the mountain 100 years ago and 29 years before Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay? The pair vanished close to the top. Nothing was known about their fate until 1999, when the remains of Mallory were discovered. But Sandy was still missing, until now. A team of climbers led by the adventurer Jimmy Chin has stumbled on a boot containing a sock and the remains of a foot, revealed by melting ice on a glacier. And as you'll hear, there seems little doubt as to its identity. I've been speaking to Sandy's great-niece and biographer Julie Summers. First, her reaction when Jimmy Chin called her with the news.
It was absolutely extraordinary because when Jimmy phoned, I wasn't thinking about Everest at all. And he was extremely polite and charming. And he introduced himself and he spoke about this accidental find he'd had of an oxygen bottle on Everest. And I nodded sagely. And then he said, and we found a boot. And I sort of looked at him over Zoom and he said, and I recognized it as being a boot from the 1920s. And the sock in it had a label. And he said it very slowly. And the label said A.C. Irvine. And I just gave a really loud gasp and I had tears in my eyes and I thought, my God, this is incredible. Because I'd literally given up hope after 25 years that we'd ever find any vestige of Sandy Irvine's remains.
And that is why it is so significant, is it?
Well, it's incredibly significant for various reasons. One is that in 1999, the expedition led by Eric Simonson, that was looking for Sandy Irvine. Because everybody believed that a description by a Chinese climber of an English dead sitting up, looking out over the mountain, everybody thought that would be Sandy Irvine. So when they found Mallory, who was lying down with his face down, that was a completely different description. So instantly Mallory's body was found, searches began, and nobody ever found anything. And eventually in 2019, an American climber called Mark Sinnott announced that he thought that the Chinese had removed Sandy's body from the mountain and were guarding it under lock and key. And I just didn't think that that was a plausible solution. So my instant reaction after the shock of hearing what Jimmy had found was relief that his body was still on the mountain, albeit chewed up in a glacier.
Tell us a bit more about your great uncle, an extraordinary man from everything that I've been reading, not least because he went on this expedition not having had much mountaineering experience. And I guess part of the reason for that is because he was very young, wasn't he?
21 when he left Britain on the 29th of February 1924. He'd had very little climbing experience, but he'd proven himself to be very strong, have a good head for heights, and be absolutely able on rock and snow, which is what you need to be on Everest. And so he was picked because he was young and he was very strong. That is exactly what General Bruce wanted when he was looking for the final member of the team. He was very practical. He'd already shown himself to be able to, you know, fix pretty well anything.
But the mystery of whether they got to the summit, well, that remains a mystery, doesn't it?
It does, because there is no proof. There are many, many theories. Some people think they didn't get to the top because they couldn't have climbed the second step, which is a very steep rock obstacle. Other people were sure they did get to the top because when Mallory's body was found, there wasn't the photograph of Ruth in his pocket, his wife, which he promised he would leave on the summit. So there are two camps. There are those who believe they did it and those who believe they didn't. But you know what? It doesn't really matter. It's just one of the greatest romantic mountaineering mysteries of all time. And the fact that they got as high as they did in the equipment they were wearing in 1924 is a feat in its own.
That was Julie Summers, the great-niece of Sandy Irvine, speaking to me a little earlier. That brings us to the end of this edition of NewsHour. Thanks so much for listening. Until the next time, bye-bye.
What are people around the world doing to help tackle the climate emergency? climate shocks that we are experiencing.
Droughts, floods, decimated agriculture and so on.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service looks for answers to those challenges posed by climate change.
How can we solve this?
It's all being discussed.
We only hear the bad stuff in the news, don't we? And there's loads of quiet progress.
Reasons to be hopeful.
Solutions exist. We just need to be able to implement them at scale.
The Climate Question. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.